should be Sunil's main god too. To convince him, Kalu took him on a barefoot, 9-mile penitence pilgrimage to the Siddhivinayak Temple in central Mumbai. Which saints and gods to follow was something about which many road boys had strong feelings. Some said Sai Baba was quicker than fat Ganpati. Others contended that Shiva could open his third eye and explode both of them. Sunil's mother had died before she could teach him about the gods, and he was too unsure of their respective merits to decide upon a favorite. Still, from what he had observed in Anuwadi, the fact that a boy knew about the gods didn't mean the gods would look after the boy. One afternoon, Abdul's mother arrived at the Dongri detention facility, rain-soaked, the skin under her eyes dark as mango stones. Abdul was sulking when he came out of the barrack, kept his head down, kicked a hard clump of mud. She had come to take him home. A judge had decided he wasn't the type to run away before his trial in juvenile court, releasing him with strict instructions. Until the trial, report to Dongri every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday to prove you haven't absconded. Abdul followed his mother down a long, stinking hallway packed with children, across the courtyard, and out onto the street. The rain had turned to drips, and there was a weak sun, low and paling. "So when's my trial?" he asked her. "When is my father's trial?"
"No one knows, but don't worry," Zerunisa said. "Just leave everything to God and keep praying. Now we have a lawyer who will say the right words, and then it will end, because the judge will pick up the truth."
"Pick up the truth," he repeated skeptically, as if truth were a coin on a footpath. He changed the subject.
"How is my father?" "They don't give medicine in Arthur Road Jail, and there's no room to sleep. Oh, it is terrible to see him there. His face has become so small. But Kekashin says it is not so bad in her jail. She prays a lot, for all of us. She says it's what Allah wants, troubles coming at us from all four sides at once."
"Why didn't you get father out first?" he asked. "It's not right that I get out before him." Sighing, Zerunisa told him of all the relatives and friends who had declined to help with the bail, and of her humiliation before the family of his supposed fiancé. "For these others, what has happened to us is just entertainment, something to talk about when they're bored," Abdul said grimly. "Now we know for certain that no one cares about us." A rich silence followed. Then he asked his mother about his garbage business. Under Mirchi's supervision, it had collapsed. The scavengers all sold to the Tamil who ran the game parlor. Abdul emitted a sound like an amplified hiccup. He might have guessed it. His parents had raised Mirchi for something better than garbage work. Even Abdul had wanted something better for Mirchi.
"Okay," he said after a while, pressing a finger deep into his twitching lower lip.
It was only mostly hopeless. He would start over, work harder than before, and try not to resent losing 3 days a week going back and forth to Dongri. Additional income would be forfeited to his decision to walk down the virtuous path recommended by the master at Dongri, and to stay out of police interrogation cells for the rest of his life. He would no longer buy stolen goods. His mother seemed fine with his decision. He hoped she'd actually been listening. She seemed half absent in her exhaustion, and definitely had been listening later when he asked if his suffering might be rewarded with an iPod. The scavengers found Abdul to be more talkative on his return from Dongri. At the scales, he kept asking whether they had procured their goods honestly. Between rounds of this newly interrogatory purchasing, he made weird little announcements. "Can I tell you something? This is the thing I have to say." Upon which, he talked endlessly about a teacher at Dongri who had seen the tawfiz, the refinement, in his nature. Abdul claimed that he spoke to the master all the time, that the guy had been so taken with Abdul that he'd given him his cell phone number. Everyone knew the garbage sorter was lying. Road boys didn't mind deception, extravagant fabrications passed the time. They were just amused that he would lie about a friendship with a teacher. The only other boy who told that kind of loser lie was Sunil, who liked to pretend to new boys that he was a fifth-grade student top of his class. Abdul had a fresh audience for his stories about the master when his semi-friend Kalu returned from the Karjat construction site in mid-September. Kalu had gained weight on account of the shortage of a race X outside the city. Zerunisa, surprised to see Kalu back so soon, called him into the house for a plate of leftovers, of which there were more than usual since the Husseins were fasting for the month of Ramadan. Zerunisa was fond of Kalu, thought he was in need of mothering. Kalu did not dispute this. He'd been calling Zerunisa Amma, or Mother, for a year, an endearment that made Abdul a little tense.
"Your father is still there in the mountains?" she asked.
"Yes, but Amma, I had to leave it. I didn't want to be out in the country now."
Mumbai was in the midst of the giddy festival in honor of his beloved Ganpati. 2 days from now, to the sound of drumbeats and cheering, millions of citizens from across Mumbai would bring lovingly crafted idols of the elephant god to the sea to immerse them. It was a celebratory practice of which environmentalists took a dim view, but which marked the high point of Kalu's year.
"You should have stayed," Zerunisa admonished him. "I can barely recognize you, you're so healthy. Why forget your father like that? You'll just slip back into your old bad ways being here."
"I'm not getting back into stealing," he promised her. "I'm good and improved now, can't you see?"
"Yes, good and improved now," Zerunisa agreed. "But can thieves really change? If they can, I haven't seen it."
The next day, Kalu scavenged for trash at the airport with Sunil. In the evening, after selling the trash to Abdul, they lingered with him outside the game shed. The three boys were ranging across the usual subjects: food, movies, girls, the price of waste, when a disabled man named Mahmood, stoned and glassy-eyed, slugged Abdul in the chest for reasons known only to himself. Another raging one leg. Of course, Abdul wasn't going to fight him. He headed home to sleep. Sunil did too. Kalu had no home to retreat to. He decided to go to the airport, taking off across the thoroughfare toward the bright blue signs that lead the way to the international terminal. Arrivals down, departures up. Happy journey. The following morning, Kalu lay outside Air India's red and white gates, a shirtless corpse with a grown-out Salman Khan haircut, crumpled behind a flowering hedge. Chapter 11. Proper Sleep. A hulking, mustachioed constable named Nagare rode his motorcycle into Anawadi. The disabled junkie who'd punched Abdul the previous night balanced on the seat behind him. The motorcycle braked hard in front of Zerunisa, who was haggling with the scavenger. She began to shake when she saw the constable's face. This Nagare did not wear the face a policeman usually wore when coming to ask for money. His was a tense, bad face she didn't know how to read. So he would be bringing some fresh trouble to compound the trouble her family was already in. No, she was being paranoid like Abdul. The constable simply wanted to know the whereabouts of Kalu's relatives, and Mahmood, the disabled junkie, had told him she was likely to know. Zerunisa felt lightheaded with relief until Nagare told her why he was asking.
"Boy's dead," he said with a frown,
and she barely had time to grieve when he sped away, because the next thing she heard was the sound of Abdul breaking down. For weeks, her eldest son had tried to forget what had happened to him in the police cell. Now, in an instant, something sealed inside him had split open. He couldn't remember the mechanics of breathing, and began to speak in a clipped, frantic tone. Kalu, his only sort of friend, dead. So now he would be arrested for the murder. The police would trap him, just as Fatima had done. "I know it," he kept saying. The addict, Mahmood, would already have told the police that Abdul had been standing on the road with Kalu the night before. This would be the evidence on which Abdul would be convicted. There would be more police beatings and, after that, decades in Arthur Road jail. He crouched and gulped, then rose and ran inside his hut, where even Kakashin, now out on bail, could not console him. He felt he needed to go into hiding again, but not, this time, in his trash pile.
"Kalu got murdered! Eyes poked out! Sickle up his ass!"
Other boys, less traumatized by life, had run to see the body, and their reports now flew through the slum lanes. Sunil refused to believe them, needed to see for himself. He took off, dodging the cars on Airport Road. The other boys had said that Kalu's body was in the garden, but which garden? 2 years into the aesthetic makeover of the airport, led by the conglomerate GVK, the place was choking with flowers. There were also gardens by the Hotel Lila, weren't there? In his distress, Sunil's mental map of his airport terrain got turned around. When he finally arrived at the correct garden, Air India and GVK executives had gathered, and the police were keeping everyone else far away. Another boy told Sunil that crows had taken Kalu's eyeballs and dropped them in the coconut trees. Sunil watched from a distance as Kalu's half-naked corpse was loaded into a police van. He watched the van drive away. All that remained to stare at was yellow police tape, dumb plastic ribbon twisting through a stand of orange heliconia, their flowers like the open beaks of baby birds. Sunil turned and walked home, past the immense pilings of the elevated expressway being constructed in the middle of Airport Road, past a line of signs GVK had planted that said, "We care, we care, we care." Past a long wall advertising floor tiles that stay beautiful forever. He felt small and sad and useless. Who had done such a thing to his friend? But the fog of shock and grief didn't fully obscure his understanding of the social hierarchy in which he lived. To Unnawadi boys, Kalu had been a star. To the authorities of the Overcity, he was a nuisance case to be dispensed with. Officially, the Sahar Police Precinct was among the safest places in Greater Mumbai. In 2 years, only 2 murders had been recorded in the whole precinct, which included the airport, hotels, office buildings, and dozens of construction site camps and slums. Both murders had been promptly solved. "All murders we detect, 100% success," was how Senior Inspector Patil, who ran the Sahar station, liked to put it. But perhaps there was a trick to this success rate, not detecting the murders of inconsequential people. Succumbed to an irrecoverable illness was the swift conclusion of Maruti Jadhav, the inspector in charge of Kalu's case. At the morgue of Cooper Hospital, the nature of the irrecoverable illness was decided. 15-year-old Deepak Rai, known as Kalu, had died of his tuberculosis, the same cause of death tagged to the bleeding scavenger who had slowly expired on the road. Active fence-climbing boys don't suddenly drop dead of tuberculosis. One thing Unnawadians know as well as pathologists is that TB deaths are torturously slow. But the evidence of Kalu's body was swiftly turned to ash in a pyre at the Parsiwada Crematorium on Airport Road. The false cause of death duly noted in an official register that had been burned through the middle by a resting cigar. Then, photos of the boy's corpse, taken in accordance with police regulations, vanished from the files at the Sahar station. As Abdul and his family had already learned, the police station was not a place where victimhood was redressed and public safety held dear. It was a hectic bazaar, like many other public institutions in Mumbai, and investigating Kalu's death was not a profit-generating enterprise. The death did, however, provide the police with an opportunity to clear the airport grounds of other Unnawadi road boys. After Kalu's death, 5 of the road boys were picked up and taken to the Sahar police station's unofficial cell. They were beaten in the name of an investigation and released with the understanding that, if they didn't stay away from the increasingly elegant airport, they might find themselves charged with Kalu's murder. The boys didn't know that the police had already filed away the case as a natural death. One of the released boys, named Karan, fled Unnawadi, fled the city, and never returned. Another, Sanjay Shetty, frantically collected garbage and took it to the Husseins in order to finance his own getaway. Zerunisa gasped when she saw him. "What happened to your face?" she asked. "Why are you crying?" 16-year-old Sanjay stood out from the other road boys for his uncommon height, his beauty, and his pronounced South Indian drawl. "Every word you say has a loving sound," Zerunisa had once teased him. "You will melt a person the way you talk." Now Sanjay could barely make words.
Calm yourself,
Zerunisa told him.
Say what happened.
Between sobs, he told her he had seen Kalu attacked by a gang of men in the darkness by the Air India gate. Then he told her of his own beating in the police station. Sanjay didn't know what to fear more, that Kalu's attackers would discover he'd been a witness and come after him, or that the cops would pick him up for another round of violent interrogation. He couldn't sleep on the Anawadi Rut Road any longer and was heading to his mother's house because he couldn't think of anywhere else to go. After his family's hut at the airport had burned down, she'd moved 5 miles south to Dharavi, the largest slum in the city. Zerunisa agreed that Dharavi was a better place than Anawadi for a boy to get lost in. She put the money in Sanjay's hand and watched him run. When Sanjay reached Dharavi, his 14-year-old sister, Anandi, was making tomato chutney for dinner. She nearly dropped the bowl when she saw the fear in his face. The two were close, and recently, in rare possession of disposable income, he'd had her first initial tattooed next to his own on his forearm. Anandi often chided him that any brother who loved his sister as much as he professed to would come home more often. But their 60-square-foot hut was too small for three people, and Sanjay liked to be near the airport, said it made him feel he had a chance to get away. Sanjay took his sister's hand, and as they sat knee-to-knee on the floor, told her of seeing a group of men swarm Kalu all at once.
They killed my friend, he kept repeating. Just threw him off,
like he was garbage. Recovering himself, Sanjay began to lecture Anandi that she shouldn't cause heartache for their mother, who was still at work, tending to an elderly woman in a middle-class neighborhood, that she should take her studies more seriously. His sister looked at him, confused.
What are you saying, Sanjay? Study? Like you, I have to work and earn, and you're the one who gives mother attention, not me.
You also should sleep properly, he said, not hearing her. I don't think you sleep so good.
Anandi didn't know what to make of her brother's paternal tone. Was it a race X? She stood up, impatient. She was sorry that this Kalu had been murdered. She'd met him once. He'd praised her cooking, made her laugh. But she couldn't just sit here holding Sanjay's hand when she had the vegetables and rice to do. As she turned back to the stove, Sanjay stretched on the floor and closed his eyes, perhaps to model his idea of proper sleep. When his mother walked in an hour later, Sanjay was up and restless, listening to a duet from an album called Pir Bewafai, Deceived in Love.
Sanjay's broken heart music,
his mother liked to call it, rolling her eyes.
Just a single misunderstanding,
the guilty husband was singing, as his betrayed wife sang back her plan of revenge. Sanjay's mother's voice rose above them both.
Going to be sick! Oh, I ate something rotten at lunch!
Bolting for the toilet, she called,
Wait, Sanjay, don't run off! I won't, he promised.
When his mother returned, his sister was hysterical, and he was convulsing on the floor. Pulling Sanjay up, thinking that he was having a seizure, his mother caught a chemical reek on his breath. His sister retrieved a white plastic bottle from the corner of the room. She'd seen him toying with it earlier, assumed it contained soap for blowing bubbles. Sanjay was crazy for soap bubbles. But the empty plastic bottle was rat poison. Sanjay rolled over to face the wall, refusing the salt water his mother prepared to force him to vomit. He lived for 2 hours after reaching the public hospital. After midnight, returning home to Dharavi, ancient with grief, his mother tossed into the gutter the prescriptions the doctor had written for Sanjay. There had been no time to go out to the road and fill them. The police inquiry into her son's death was closed as swiftly as the inquiry into Kalu's death had been. In the public record, Sanjay Shetty would be neither a vulnerable witness to a murder nor the victim of police threats and beatings. He would be a heroin addict who had decided to kill himself because he couldn't afford his next fix. In Delhi, politicians and intellectuals privately bemoaned the irrationality of the uneducated Indian masses. But when the government itself provided false answers to its citizens' urgent concerns, rumor and conspiracy took wing. Sometimes the conspiracies became a consolation for loss. Trying to make sense of the deaths of Kalu and Sanjay, Sunil and Abdul grew closer. Not quite friends, rather an unnameable, not entirely willing category of relationship in which two boys felt themselves bound to two boys who were dead. Sunil and Abdul sat together more often than before, but when they spoke, it was with the curious formality of people who shared the understanding that much of what was said did not matter, and that much of what mattered could not be said. Sunil felt certain that Air India security guards had murdered Kalu upon catching him in their recycling piles. Abdul suspected Kalu had been killed by drug dealers on whom he'd informed. "It was a dog's death either way," Abdul said, often, which made Sunil think of the strangled dog in the Will Smith movie that he and Kalu had seen at Pinky Talkie Town. Mirchi felt both boys should drop the subject.
"Yeah, he stole garbage, but it was their garbage, so of course he was going to die like that."
Road boys blamed other road boys.
"Mahmood, my full doubt is on him. Karan probably did it, then ran away."
A corrosive, free-floating distrust worked its way down the slum lanes. Fatima's ghost may or may not have been involved. Kalu's father turned against the woman whose airport road stall Kalu had frequented for chicken chili rice. She heard things, and Kalu's father had counted on her to tell him what had really happened.
"Kalu what? Kalu who?"
she had said, staring into her cook pot. In the end, for the refusal of the police and the morgue to tell the truth about the death of his son, he would blame the chicken chili rice woman most of all. Sanjay's mother didn't know whom to blame. For weeks after her son's suicide, she walked unsteadily through Annawadi, asking everyone she passed if they could tell her why her son had taken his life.
"How do I sleep without knowing?" she asked her daughter. "The whole world is in my head, and it doesn't make sense."
Sunil and the road boys were torn when they saw Sanjay's mother coming. They'd known her before she'd moved to Dharavi. They'd liked her laugh and the generosity with which she'd shared her cooking. That she now looked 300 years old suggested just how much she'd loved her son. But how to explain Sanjay's death without talking about Kalu's, without talking about the Sahar police? Even the Tamil who ran the game shed and whose police contacts were intimate was afraid to say Kalu's name. So Sanjay's mother learned only what another mother, who slept on pavement, dared to whisper.
"Your boy died with fear in his heart."
The soil outside the red and white Air India gate was good and loamy. Gradually, with the ministrations of the airport gardening crew, a boy-sized break in the flowers filled in. One afternoon, Sunil crouched there, studying the skin of the earth. He could find no trace of damage. Part 4. Up and Out.
"Don't confuse yourself by thinking about such terrible lives."
Zerunisa Hussain. Chapter 12. 9 Nights of Dance. By late September 2008, Asha was in control of Annawadi. There had been no clinching event, no slum boss coronation. Rather, it had been a campaign of small advances toward the moment when the line of supplicants extended outside her hut. Policemen promptly returned her calls, and corporator Subhash Sawant, on hand to address the residents, offered her the plastic chair beside his own. Her patron had regained his confidence now that the faked caste certificate case against him seemed tied up in court. Seated beside him on the stage by the sewage lake, Asha looked nearly his equal, sporting a gold chain much like his own. Hers had been financed by her self-help group and the high-interest loans it made to poorer women. Relaxing into her authority, Asha stopped making elaborate excuses to her family about the men she met late at night. When her husband threatened suicide, she consoled him but made no promise to change. She let herself gain 10 pounds, which softened the lines beneath her eyes, a last trace of her years in the fields. Her main regret was the lack of a confidant with whom to relish this fledgling triumph. Her secrets had isolated her from other women. She'd had to close certain doors to herself.
"What friend do I really have?" she would say to Manju. But now, even her daughter seemed remote. On the rare occasion that Manju met her eye, she would bring up Asha's least favorite subject, the one leg.
While the deaths of Kallu and Sanjay shook the boys who lived on the road, Fatima's death was the one that strobed in and out of the minds of Anawadi women. 2 months after the public spectacle of her burning, it had insinuated itself into countless private narratives. Fatima's regret at what she'd done had been forgotten, her act reconstrued as a flamboyant protest. What exactly she had been protesting was subject to interpretation. To the poorest, her self-immolation was a response to enervating poverty. To the disabled, it reflected the lack of respect accorded the physically impaired. To the unhappily married, who were legion, it was a brave indictment of oppressive unions. Almost no one spoke of envy, a stone slab, a poorly made wall, or rubble that had fallen into rice. One night, the brothel keeper's wife doused herself with kerosene in the Maidan, called out Fatima's name, and threatened to light a match. Another night, a woman beaten by her husband did light the match. She survived in such a state that Manju and her friend Mina, in their secret nightly meetings at the public toilet, began discussing more foolproof means of suicide. Only 15-year-old Mina knew that Manju had considered taking her life the night that Asha had run out on her 40th birthday party, and on other nights after that. As Manju became consumed with shame and worry over her mother's affairs, Mina could only offer perspective. Her own parents and brothers beat her regularly, with force, and the big expeditions punctuating her housekeeping days were visits to the public tap and the toilet. In Mina's opinion, any mother who financed her daughter's college education, rarely slapped her, and hadn't arranged her marriage at age 15 could be forgiven for other failings. Mina encouraged Manju to express the worst of her thoughts. It was said to be the modern, healthy way of coping.
"You always say that the flowers I put in my hair never turn sticky and brown," she told Manju one night at the toilet. "My flowers live because I don't keep anything dark in my heart. I let the bad things come out into the air."
Manju winced. She didn't want her mother's behavior to be more in the air than it already was.
"My heart must be black then," she replied, deflecting. "The flowers in my hair die in 2 hours."
Manju thought it wiser to practice the denial about which she'd been learning in psychology class. Just stop thinking about her mother altogether.
"If I don't block it out, I won't be able to study," she said.
The exams that would determine whether she would become Anawadi's first female college graduate were only a few months away. Based on his theory of the unconscious, Freud tells us how a fantasy is an unsatisfied wish which is fulfilled to the imagination. He divides fantasies into 2 main groups, A, ambitious wishes, B, erotic. Young men have mostly ambitious wishes. Young women have mostly erotic ones. The ordinary person feels ashamed of his fantasies and hides them. By hearting the psychology notes her teacher provided, Manju realized she needed to block out a second painful subject. Vijay, the middle-class hero of the Civil Defense Corps who had once gripped her hand.
"In my next birth, you can be my wife," he had recently told her. "Not this time."
Late September was the season of romantic contemplation for many young women in Anawadi. The annual flirt fest, the Navratri festival, was about to begin. The holidays the boys anticipated most were Holi and Handi. On Holi, they attacked each other with balloons full of colored water. On Handi, they made human ladders and belly-flopped into the mud. Slum girls weren't allowed to roll in mud. Navratri, 9 nights of dance, was the festival in which they could be equals, even betters of the boys. Over these nights, at the end of the monsoon season, the goddess Durga was said to battle the evil of the universe and triumph. Feminine divinity was celebrated, and even Mina received parental permission to dance and shine. On the first night of the previous Navratri, Mina and Manju had spent hours getting ready. A dark blue sari for Manju, who could pull it off now that she had breasts and hips, like her mother. Stylish red salwar kameez for Mina, who stayed reedy no matter how many good day biscuits she put away. Mina found it hard work not to be dazzled by Manju. Her figure, her fairness, her ability to stand back straight, butt in, perfectly still. Mina's own deportment was fidget and twist. But when she threw back her head and laughed, T, teeth gleaming. Hers was the edgier beauty. She looked like one of those girls who made exciting things happen. Exciting things didn't happen, though, and certainly not on the Navratri of 2007. The two girls had swanned onto the Maidan for the first night of dancing, only to be drenched by the season's final downpour. The stage by the sewage lake was the only mudless place. The feral pigs that camped beside it reeked of a too-long monsoon. The Navratri of 2008 could only be better, since Asha would be choreographing it. She knew what these 9 nights meant to girls. Among her plans were a band, a DJ with powerful speakers, a large pandal to house an idol of the goddess Durga, and fairy lights strung up over the Maidan under which the dancing would wheel. The leaders of Shiv Sena and the rival Congress Party had contributed money for this extravaganza. Elections were approaching and, with millions of slum voters to be won over, the city's political class was in a generous mood. Anawadians were in need of exuberant distraction as a recession that had begun in the West arrived in India. Suddenly, once profitable links to the global markets were pushing the slum dwellers backward. The price of recyclable goods declined. Temp work in construction dried up as projects that had stopped in the monsoon stalled again for lack of foreign financing. Meanwhile, the price of food was soaring, largely on account of poor rains and harvests in Vidarbha and other agricultural strongholds. The political response to this hardship, DJs and colored lights, was a time-honored tradition in Mumbai. On festival days before elections, the city slums became as bright as the wealthy neighborhoods with their pakka buildings, and 10 times louder. Meena was all for bands, amps, and twinkling lights. This would be her last Navratri before starting a life she dreaded, as a teenage bride in a Tamil Nadu village. Meena had once taken pride in having been the first girl born in Anawadi. But as she prepared to leave Mumbai, it troubled her that domestic labor in the slum was all she had learned of her city. Nothing a girl cleaned in Anawadi stayed clean. Why did people see it as a failure of the girl? Why did her mother scream at her when, like everyone else, she lost 2 hours of her morning standing in line for water at a dribbling tap? Everything on television announced a new and better India for women. Her favorite Tamil soap opera was about an educated single girl who worked in an office. In her favorite commercials, a South Indian movie siren named Asan was recommending, along with Mirinda orange soda, more fun, a little wildness. This new India of feisty, convention-defying women wasn't a place Meena knew how to get to. Maybe Manju would get there with her college degree. Meena couldn't say, not knowing any woman who had finished college. But watching the soap operas and Mirinda commercials, she sometimes felt her own life to be a husk of an existence. Things were inflicted upon her, regular beatings, the new engagement to marry. But what did she ever get to decide? A boy, not her fiancé, had recently fallen in love with her. In the soap operas, such a thing would be explosive. In her constricted life, it was a small but welcome distraction. The boy was a friend of her older brother, a factory worker from a nearby slum who was about to take a house-cleaning job in the Persian Gulf, the only way he thought he could make enough money to someday support a wife and family. One night, while visiting her brother, he slipped Meena his phone number. Another night, at a public phone, she dialed it. During the 6th or 8th illicit phone call, he said she was the future wife for whom he was striving. The flirtation had gone too far. Meena gave him what she thought was a respectable response. "It's okay if you love me. I'm glad that you do. But I am going to be married to someone else, so you must think of me only as a friend." Manju was relieved to hear it, since Meena was a see-through kind of girl, poorly suited to sneaking around. Her brothers had twice caught her on the phone and slapped her for it.
"Anyway," Manju pointed out, "you said last month that you liked the village boy."
Meena did like the village boy, who called on Sundays. He washed his own dinner plate, an astonishment to Meena and Manju, since he could have ordered his sister to do it for him. The boy was not the problem. The problem was an arranged marriage at age 15. Meena's father spoke rapturously of the feeling she was supposed to have being engaged.
"The first time your hearts meet,
Nothing else is left. Manju's father took a more cynical view. No marriage is happy after it happens. It's only before, thinking of it, that it's happy. But Mina didn't feel euphoric anticipation. She couldn't see how love would alter the daily practicalities. What if over the verge of marriage stretched an adult life even more confined than her childhood had been? To both Mina and Manju, marrying into a village family was like time traveling backward. In Asha's village, people of the Kunbi caste still considered Dalits like Mina contaminated, unhygienic people relegated to the outskirts of town and tolerated in Kunbi homes only when picking up garbage or dredging drains. If a Dalit touched a cup in such a house, it had to be destroyed. Those villagers would be appalled if they saw how Manju leaned against her friend, or learned that the two girls shared a sky-blue sari. Manju had worn the sari on the Maharashtrian New Year the previous spring. Mina had worn it, draped with narrower pleats, for the Tamil New Year.
"I feel too fluffy and puffy wearing it your way," she told Manju.
Mina would rightfully get to wear it for her final Navratri in Mumbai.
"I'm afraid my mother will decide to marry me to that soldier from the village," Manju said one night in the toilet, where they always made a point of turning their backs to the slum.
Ever since Asha had taken Manju home to Vidarbha, Rahul had been teasing her about her rural future.
"You'll have to cover your head and clean and cook for your mother-in-law, and your husband will be away in the army and you'll be so lonely."
"So what will you do if your mother sets up such a marriage?" Mina asked. "I'll run to my aunt, I think. She would protect me. How could I spend my life like that?"
"Maybe it's better just to do what Fatima did," Mina said. "Escape the situation if you know you're going to be miserable. But I would kill myself by eating poison, not by burning. If you burned yourself, the last memory people would have of you is with your skin all spoiled and scary."
"Why are you still thinking like that?" Manju admonished. "You were sick for a week after you saw Fatima's body lying there. You'll get sick again if you don't push such thoughts out of your mind the way I do."
As they whispered, they couldn't help looking around every once in a while to make sure there was no sign of the one leg. Although her curses floated through Anawadi, wreaking havoc in any number of huts, her actual ghost was known to be lodged in these very toilets. Slum dwellers remembered her walking there, tink, 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 dolled up in lipstick. Many of them had decided it was safer to shit outside.
"Don't worry," Rahul told the girls. "The one leg didn't take her crutches with her when she died, so her ghost won't be able to run and catch you."
Manju more or less believed this, and also knew that first-class people did not subscribe to ghost talk. Mina was unapologetically superstitious, though. Recently, her mother reported seeing a snake slither across a menstrual cloth that Mina had too casually discarded. Her mother had been hysterical, said it foretold that Mina's womb would shrivel up. Manju suspected that Mina's mother hadn't really seen a snake, and was simply getting more creative in her attempts to keep Mina docile before marriage. But Mina was shaken.
"I'm going to dry up and die," she cried one night.
Married women without children were suspect in Mumbai, and to be barren in a village? Mina started to feel skittish at the toilet. The serpent curse and Fatima's ghost struck her as a risky convergence. Still, she lingered, couldn't not linger. The minutes in the night stench with Manju were the closest she had ever come to freedom. The day before Asha's Navratri began, the Maidan underwent a fury of beautification. Abdul and his garbage piles were banished, and women swept and swept. A teenage boy shimmied up the flagpole to anchor the strings of lights, while other boys climbed onto hut roofs to affix the ends of the strings to corrugated eaves. Tonight, Manju and Asha would fetch the idol of Durga from a nearby neighborhood, the arrival of which would complete the holiday preparations. Now, returning from college in the early afternoon, Manju rushed across the Maidan, wondering how she could teach school, memorize a plot summary for English literature, and do the housework on a day when the goddess getting would consume at least an hour.
"We'll come before dinner,"
she called out to Mina, who was waving from the doorway of her hut. Manju didn't intend to be caught with unfinished laundry on a week when dancing privileges could be taken away. 4 hours later,
clothes on the line and the final round of head, shoulders, knees and toes completed, Manju walked over to Mina's. Her friend was sitting in her doorway, looking out at the tidy Maidan. This was odd. Mina's parents didn't let her sit on the stoop, said it gave a girl a loose reputation. Manju settled in beside her. Late afternoon was the time many girls and women of Anawadi took a break from housework before beginning their dinner preparations. When they were younger, Mina and Manju had spent their free minutes playing hopscotch in front of the hut, but marriageable teenage girls couldn't jump around. Mina looked wan and wasn't as fidgety as usual, but she was fasting as she did every Navratri to please the goddess Durga. From time to time, Mina bent over and spit in the dust.
"Are you getting sick?" Manju asked after a while.
Mina shook her head and spit again.
"So what are you doing?"
Manju said in a low voice, suddenly suspicious.
"Chewing tobacco?"
"With her mother right there inside the hut?"
"Just spitting,"
Mina said with a shrug. Feeling a little aggrieved at Mina's failure to entertain her, Manju rose to return to her work.
"Wait,"
said Mina, holding out her hand. In her palm was an empty tube of rat poison. Mina met her eyes, and Manju went flying into the hut where Mina's mother was grinding rice to make idlis. Manju's words came forth in a torrent. "Rat poison, Mina, foolish, going to die." Mina's mother kept grinding the rice.
"Calm down, she's playing a trick,"
she told Manju.
"She said a few weeks back that she'd eaten poison, and nothing happened."
Mina's mother was fed up with her daughter. The prospect of dancing had apparently caused the girl to lose her senses. Mina had been discovered talking on the phone to the city boy at 2 a.m. and taken a beating for it. At lunchtime, she refused to make her younger brother an omelet because she was fasting and didn't want to be tempted by food. Took a beating for that, too. Her brother was about to give her the third beating of the day for sitting outside the house when she concocted this story about having eaten poison. Manju was momentarily reassured by Mina's mother. But if Mina was manufacturing a drama, wouldn't she let Manju in on it? Manju went back outside, leaned into her friend's face, and sniffed. Manju thought of cartoon dragons exhaling fire and smoke. Later, she kept thinking she saw smoke coming out of Mina's mouth and nose, as if the girl had set herself on fire from the inside. No, that was impossible. Rat poison only. Her mind was looping. If she screamed for help, the whole slum would know that Mina had attempted suicide, which would ruin her reputation. Quiet seemed essential. She ran to a payphone to call Asha.
"Mummy," she whispered. "Mina ate rat poison. Her mother doesn't believe, and I don't know what to do."
"Oh, shit," said Asha. "You've got to force her to swallow tobacco right away. That will make her puke everything out."
But what would people say if Manju was seen buying tobacco? Manju chased down some Tamil women on Mina's slum lane, hoping they would have a better idea.
"She poisoned herself," she hissed. "Help me. I don't know what to do."
They shook their heads.
"So many fights in that family lately,"
someone said.
"No,"
Manju cried, forgetting to be quiet.
"Don't be calm. You have to do something."
Mina had come over, was standing beside her.
"Did you really swallow it?"
one of the women asked.
"I did,"
Mina said, her voice mild.
"Did you take all of it?"
Manju demanded. A woman on this slum lane had recently consumed half a tube of the same brand of poison, Ratol, and survived.
"All of it,"
Mina said, then leaned forward to gag, spirals of hair spilling over her face. When the gagging stopped, she started to talk very fast, that the Ratol cost 40 rupees at the Merrill market, that she had stolen change from her brothers and father to buy it, something about always getting beaten. Something about her brother and an omelet, but not just about that. She wasn't acting out of anger, as Fatima had done. She'd thought it through, had consumed 2 tubes of rat poison on 2 other days, but had started to vomit, which led her this time to mix the poison with milk. She hoped the milk would keep the poison in her stomach long enough to kill her. This was one decision about her life she got to make. It wasn't a choice easily shared with a best friend. Meena sat again with a heaviness that had nothing to do with her weight. A woman materialized with a bowl of water and salt.
"This will make her vomit,"
she said, tipping back Mina's head. She swallowed. Everyone waited. Dry heaves. Nothing. Water and laundry soap, another woman suggested, running home to chop up a foul-smelling bar of madhumati. Meena held her nose as the second brew went down her throat. Finally, she vomited a jet of bright green froth.
"I feel better," Meena announced eventually. "It's all out."
Her face slick with sweat, she stood unsteadily, and her mother led her inside to sleep off the effects of the poison. As the door shut behind them, the women of the slum lane exhaled. Feminine discretion had averted a scene, perhaps saved a wedding. Meena's future in-laws might not come to hear that they'd chosen an impetuous bride. The shopkeeper two huts down kept selling milk and sugar, unaware. Construction workers returning from work tramped through soapy green vomit. Manju registered through a screen of exhaustion that it was evening and that she needed not to be standing disheveled outside her friend's closed door. She needed to wash her face and get the goddess Durga. As she and Asha left to pick up the idol, Meena's elder brother arrived home, learned that her sister had consumed rat poison, and beat her for it. Meena wept and went to sleep. Just before midnight, she started to cry again. Eventually, her father realized that this was not sad crying. On the first night of Navratri, as the young people of Annawadi, minus Manju, danced in the illuminated clearing, Meena answered the question of a police officer who had come to her bedside at Cooper Hospital. Had anyone incited her to attempt suicide?
"I blame no one," said Meena. "I decided for myself."
On the third night of Navratri, Meena stopped talking, at which point Cooper Hospital doctors extracted 5,000 rupees from her parents in the name of imported injections. On the sixth day of Navratri, Meena was dead.
"She was fed up with what the world had to offer,"
the Tamil women concluded. Meena's family, upon consideration, decided that Manju's modern influence was to blame. The lights of Navratri came down. Rahul tried to make Manju laugh again, and thought she'd smiled a little the day he pointed out that Meena's younger brother had lost something too.
"That boy will never want to eat an omelette again."
In a certain morning light, Manju could see the name Meena traced faintly in a broken piece of cement just outside the toilet.
"Only in that light," she said, "and even then it's barely there."
Another lesser Meena lived in Annawadi, and a man who loved that Meena had once carved her name on the inside of his forearm. Manju thought he'd probably written Meena in the wet cement, too. It stood to reason. But she preferred to believe that Meena's own finger had made the letters, and that the first girl born in Annawadi had left some mark of herself on the place. Chapter 13. Something Shining. In November, the waste market in Freefall, the Tamil who owned the game shed tried to help the scavengers grasp why their trash was worth so little.
"The banks in America went in a loss. Then the big people went in a loss. Then the scrap market in the slum areas came down too."
This was how he explained the global economic crisis. A kilo of empty water bottles, once worth 25 rupees, was now worth 10. And a kilo of newspaper, once worth 5 rupees, was now worth 2. This was how the global crisis was understood. The newspapers Sunil collected said that a lot of Americans were now living in their cars or in tents under bridges. The richest man in India, Mukesh Ambani, had also lost money. Billions. Although not enough to impede construction on his famed 27-story house in South Mumbai. The lower stories would be reserved for cars and the 600 servants required by his family of 5. Far more interesting to young slum dwellers was the fact that Ambani's helicopters would land on the roof.
"Things will get better soon," Abdul told Sunil and the other scavengers, because that was what his father told him.
Although the global markets were volatile, the behavior of tourists could be predicted. They inundated Mumbai in the winter.
Indians who lived abroad began arriving in November for the Diwali holiday. Europeans and Americans came in December. The Chinese and Japanese came soon after, and the hotels and airport boomed until January's end. With the influx of travelers, Anawadians decided, the losses of monsoon and recession would be recovered. One night in late November, Sunil was in the game shed after an unprofitable day of scavenging, watching two boys at one of the red consoles play Metal Slug 3. On the video screen, gorillas were fighting policemen and mutant lobsters in the streets of a bombed-out city. Outside the game parlor, other Anawadians started getting loud. Sunil eventually realized that the commotion was not the usual Erase X bullshit. People were pressed against the window of the hut where the game shed owner lived, watching a news report on the man's TV. Muslim terrorists from Pakistan had floated in rubber boats onto a Mumbai beach and were running loose in the city. The jihadis had taken over two luxury hotels, the Taj and the Oberoi, slaughtering workers and tourists. People were also dead at a place called Leopold Cafe, and reports of more than 100 other casualties were coming in from the city's largest train station. Before long, a photo of one of the terrorists filled the television screen. Black t-shirt, knapsack, running shoes. He looked like a college kid, except for the automatic weapon. The attacks were taking place 17 miles from Anawadi, in the wealthy southern part of the city. To Sunil, a reassuring remove. He was interested when the television people said the terrorists might have bombs. The bombs in his second favorite video game, Bomberman, were black and round with long sizzle fuses. Circus music played when they exploded. But a taxi had blown up near Airport Road, and older boys were saying that the airport itself would be a logical target. Manju speculated that if the terrorists had invaded five-star hotels in South Mumbai, they might also come to the five-star hotels by the airport, might even come through Anawadi to get to these hotels. Mercifully, her unit of the Indian Civil Defense Corps was not being called upon to aid in this particular crisis. She went into her house and shut the door. Abdul's parents were afraid to do the same. What if Anawadi Hindus decided the slum's Muslims were part of some plot? Door open, Karam Hussein turned on the TV. As Abdul covered his head with a sheet, one of his little brothers drew close to the screen. The architecture in the colonial part of the city was beautiful to the younger boy. The red turrets rising up behind the reporters at the Taj, the ornate facade of the train station. Here in Anawadi, every home looked a little like the family who had made it. But even when besieged, this South Mumbai seemed to him majestically coherent, like a single mind made the whole place. Early the next morning, Sunil and Sonu, the blinky boy, set off for work, only to discover that scavenging was out of the question. The airport perimeter was sealed, and military commandos with long black guns clustered on Airport Road. The boys ran back to Anawadi and the television of the man who owned the game shed. The Taj Hotel had been burning, terrorists and tourists were still inside, and the newscaster said people all over the world were following the drama. Outside the hotel, well-dressed people wiped away tears as they told reporters what the Taj meant to them. Sunil understood that the rich people were mourning the devastation of a place where they had relaxed and felt safe. In his equivalent place, the 96-square-foot game shed, no one cried about the siege of South Mumbai or about the hundreds of people dead and injured. Instead, slum dwellers worried for themselves. By the time the attack ended, 60 hours after it had begun, many Anawadians had accurately predicted the chain of economic consequences. A city in which terrorists killed foreign tourists in hotels was not a place other foreign tourists would want to spend their winter holidays. There would not be a peak season in Anawadi this winter. The airport would be quiet, the hotels empty. When midnight came on January 1, there would be few partiers at the Intercontinental shouting Happy New Year. Instead, 2009 arrived in the slum under a blanket of poverty, the global recession overlaid by a crisis of fear. More Anawadians had to relearn how to digest rats. Sonu deputized Sunil to catch frogs at Naupada slum, since Naupada frogs tasted better than sewage-like ones. The deranged scavenger who talked to the luxury hotels stopped accusing the Hyatt of plotting to kill him. Instead, he pleaded to its non-reflective blue glass front.